Tailwind, Tip of the Trail by Don Freeman.
Well, I'm going to bring you something that I'm experiencing right now. And we kind of brought it up on the last podcast with Martin Dugard and his book. And we talked about just putting in the time, just getting up every day and on your training days, and just don't expect any miracles. Don't expect it to happen fast, and just keep it up. And all of a sudden, bang, out of nowhere comes fitness. It just shows up on your doorstep. That here you are.
It just shows up on your doorstep.
That has been my experience with this returning to fitness, and you go through it over and over again because you're never always at your peak.
See, I'm just waiting at home for it to show up on my doorstep. What you're saying is I have to leave.
You have to open the door.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so that's what I've really been experiencing right now, and it's real fun to watch the process happen. When all of a sudden you're closing in on that last stretch and you go, it's happened. It happened.
I got it.
I'm there. And it's like Christmas in August.
And that's what Tailwind Nutrition is like. Once you try it, you're going to go, where have you been all my life?
Is that right, Scott?
That's when I first tried it, I went, okay, this stuff, first of all, I like it.
Uh-huh.
And then you experience it and you train with it and you go, you know what? This stuff works.
It does.
And that's the reason why they've been so successful. Go to tailwindnutrition.com. Check out the many different flavors. Check out the Tailwind Challenge.
And check out the map in all the locations all over the globe that it's located. So people will tell you, you know, the people's bottles that are being filled are the votes that say yes to Tailwind.
You know, we haven't talked about it for a long time, but we're still getting people that are very interested in the powers of the performance-enhancing Cocapelli.
Back up, Scott. The powers of a performance-enhancing Cocapelli, just in case I'm new to the trail and new to the podcast, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
We're talking about the temporary tattoos that we have unofficially been licensed to use from the Cocapelli. If you go to our website and click on the store, you can get a 20-pack of these performance-enhancing Cocapellis. The reason why you get 20 is so you can share them. That's really where the exponential powers come to play.
Well, the other piece of that is once you've tried it, you don't want to be without it.
Yeah.
The thing actually works. And so what kind of performance? Will I be able to read people's minds? Will I be able to walk through walls? What are you talking about?
Well, all of the above. We found that they work in running, and that's the reason why we have the temporary tattoo on our website, is because we think that it will enhance your running experience. But it has been proven that it works outside of running. I slap one on for big business meetings, and it makes me perform.
Scott, I was caught without one, and it was a very important meeting. I drew one on with ink pen.
Yep,
and
you shot me a photo.
It worked, and it's more the spirit of the performance-enhancing Cocapelli than the ink that we use or the official nature of it. It looks best when you apply it from a TRN store, but you know, in a pinch, if you're out on a run and you're bonking, I would go as far as taking something that's stainable that can draw on the skin.
A mini Sharpie is what I carry in my fanny pack. I carry some Succeed, some goo, and a Sharpie.
Go to the TRN store, get yourself a Sharpie or the actual TRN Cocapelli, and find your way to a better place when you apply the Cocapelli.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott War, and we have once again our favorite author, Matt Fitzgerald, on. I think this is his fourth time being on the podcast, if my math and fingers can count correctly.
Well, you're still on one hand. You're safe. I'd say that's exactly right.
And we feel a little honored because we are going to talk about a book that is not yet available to the general public. It makes us feel a little elite.
Yeah.
It's the only time that I feel elite, because I definitely won't at the race course. But one of the things as we got into this, well, let me first of all, thanks for joining us, Matt. Appreciate you coming on.
Pleasure to be here. By the way, when do I exhaust my eligibility? Is there a limit to how many times I can be on the show?
No, because Scott and I are still on it. So
Alec Baldwin, I think, has been on Saturday Night Live 10 times. So once you exceed that, we'll start questioning. But the book is called How Bad Do You Want It? Mastering the Psychological Mind Over Muscle. And we got a small taste of this, I think it was in April, when Matt came up to the American River 50 race. We did a banquet the day before, and he talked to the people that came to the banquet. And he kind of gave us a little bit of a taste about mind over matter. And he gave us a story. You remember the story he gave us?
I do.
It was about Marines. Was it Marines? And running on a treadmill? You don't remember?
He has a lot of stories. Why don't you refresh all of our memories?
Maybe I'm remembering incorrectly, but I think it was Marines, and they put these Marines on a treadmill, and they said, we want you to go hard as long as you can. And so they went hard as long as they could until they were completely exhausted and just gave up. And they said, okay, now what we want you to do is get right back on that treadmill before they could recover and run for 20 more seconds. And they were able to do it for like 20 more seconds. Am I paraphrasing the story properly?
It was rugby players.
I knew it was some macho kind of guy.
Yeah. Really, honestly, close enough.
It was a rugby player that used to be a Marine.
Yeah, there we go.
And it was stationary bikes, not no, but you have the spirit of the study.
What I got out of it was once you think that you're completely exhausted and you can't go on any further, if you're given a small goal, you can always do a little bit more. And that's what I got out of that. And he mentioned this book that he was in the process of writing, and we got real excited about it. And so we reached out, and as soon as it became available in the pre-press release version, we were lucky enough to get a copy. And so that's why we're talking to Matt today.
So, Matt, when do you expect this book to be released to the masses, so that those that are listening to this and would possibly like to check on Scott's facts of the rest of his stories, they can?
As chance would have it, the publisher, they just informed me that they received copies from the printer today. So it'll start, the bookstores, all the retailers online and brick and mortar will be receiving it, in the next several days. People who have pre-ordered it will start to receive it, maybe even next week or early the week after.
Okay.
Awesome.
So it's a fun read. It's not just a how-to book. There's a lot of, like Matt does in most of his books, is he brings a lot of stories, real world stories and experiences into this, and makes it fun to read, and then backs it up with a science.
So let's talk about the name of the book. How Bad Do You Want It? Let me see the smaller print there, Scott. Mastering the Physiology of Mind Over Muscle.
Psychology. You guys both massacred that subtitle.
Psychology. PSY. You know, it's a good thing I know the editor. Ready?
You know what? Can we start this one over? I've totally screwed this podcast up. We're an edit-free podcast, Matt.
Okay, so if I were to do it again, it would sound something like this. Well, as I reach out and grab this book and read the title, it says, How Bad Do You Want It? The Mastering...
You can do it.
As I reach out and grab this book, How Bad Do You Want It? By Matt Fitzgerald, Mastering the Psychology of Mind Over Muscle. Great title. Tell us a little bit about why you picked this title.
Yeah, so to me, that phrase, how bad you want it, actually, I'll tell you, there's one of the stories I tell in the book is about an American female runner, Alyssa McCaig, who... I saw her run at the USA Track and Field Championships in 2011. She was in the 5,000 meters, and she choked. She's talented. She's hardworking. She was ready, but she just bombed. And during the race, one of her teammates, David Jankowski, I was standing next to him watching the race, and when she came around the corner, he cupped his hands around his mouth and said, "Alyssa, get on your horse. How bad do you want it?" Mm.
And I thought that, you know, that expression is really emblematic of that moment that every endurance athlete experiences in every race when it's gut check time. You know, it's a hard sport that we have chosen. It's, you know, it's really, racing gets really uncomfortable. And you know, unless you're just dogging that, you know, that particular race, you face that moment where you have to decide, like, how bad do I want this? Like, how much more am I willing to suffer, you know, in pursuit of whatever my goal is for this race? So that experience is something that's familiar to everyone. I think that title sort of captures that, and that's really what the book is about. The scientists call it perception of effort. You know, in those moments when you are really suffering, you're at the limit of your tolerance for perception of effort. You know, that's the essence of what makes endurance sports hard. And so the book is really about the book makes the case that perception of effort is really what this sport is all about, that we are limited by that more than we are by our physiology. We're at least limited more directly by that psychology than we are by our bodies. And so the book gets into the science and also, you know, the how-to. And the athletes come in as sort of examples, the elite athletes, of how do you overcome those challenges? You know, when you fail, when you don't step up. You know, Alyssa McCaig, she choked in that race, but she overcame it. She was able to get over that problem. So that's where the title comes from, and that's what the book is all about.
So, you know, as we do often on this podcast, we talk about how running is a microcosm of real life, and there's something. How bad do you want it? Extends well beyond just the trail. It can move anywhere. You know, relationships, jobs, other goals, financial goals. It could be anything. Time that you put away to do something else, to sit up on a hill and just watch the clouds go by. How bad do you want some of these things? And the discipline from running, I think, extends into the rest of our lives.
Yeah, it really goes both ways. And one of the themes of the book is the idea that the mind is the athlete. There is no separation between your personality and your mental strengths and weaknesses as an athlete. You know, whatever your psychology is in everyday life, you bring that psychology onto the race course. And so, you know, whatever holds you back mentally is on the race course is probably holding you back mentally in life or psychologically in life as well. So, you know, just returning to that example of Alyssa McCaig, who had a choking problem that she was able to overcome, that choking was the result of insecurity, which was a part of her personality. She just had trouble believing in herself, and that manifested inside of the sport of running and outside it as well. And really, in order to get past her choking problem, she had to grow as a human being. And one of the points I make in the book is that, you know, traditional sports psychology, the art of goal setting and you know, imagining the perfect race, those techniques really only scratch the surface. You know, if you want to make real progress and attain real mental fitness as an athlete, you have to change as a person. It's just not a matter of just employing a grab bag of handy techniques.
And I guess you would expect it to be that way. You wouldn't become a different person just because you put on a pair of shoes and went out on the trail. You're gonna have those same qualities and characteristics of being very optimistic and determined and ready for any obstacle and creative and overcome each one of them. And we can practice that out on the trail and become better at them, because we can always improve and then apply those newly developed or keen skills to the to real world experiences.
Exactly. That's why, you know, psychologists often use, instead of the word personality, they use coping style. Coping style is basically your personality. The reason you have a personality is because your personality is really just a collection of the methods you use to cope as a human being in the world. And so a lot of all the stories I tell in the book are examples of great athletes who have developed coping skills. And they're all, you know, they're not just sport specific. They are, you know, skills, like you said, that serve you in everyday life and as an athlete.
I think if I was to try to describe to someone, Scott, or any trail runner that has his background in trail running and accomplishments that he's done, and I was trying to introduce them and instill confidence in his character, and whether it was for business or anything that I was making this connection, I think I would absolutely use the fact that he's persevered 100 miles through difficult travels, and you can count on this guy. He's a finisher, and he is determined, and he can overcome those obstacles. I think it speaks volumes, just part of your running resume to how it reflects in real life. That's a thought that just came to my mind.
So I have a question. I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around this. We talk about, and we've talked about this on a number of podcasts, that when you go into an endurance race, you have to have a reason to finish. If you go in Yep. there just well-trained and really don't have a reason, a why, if you will, your chances of succeeding are going to go down. You sure you could do it without a why, but and just for the pure enjoyment. But if you have a why, when you get to those difficult times in the race, you can draw upon that. So I guess my question is, maybe that's a trick that you were talking about, Matt. Maybe that's one of the little tips or techniques that you can use. Is there a way to really just develop a mental toughness versus using these tricks and traits? And is it, and here's the second part of my question, it comes back to the nature versus nurture thing. Is it something that some people are born with and have a better capability of, or is it something that is trained that you have to learn?
Yeah. So here's what I would say in response to that. So, What this new science or this new psychology of perception of effort has taught us is that you cannot improve as an athlete except by changing your relationship to perception of effort. There are two ways you can do that. You can increase the maximum amount of perceived effort you can tolerate, and you can also get more performance out of any given amount of effort so you can sort of become more efficient.
I want you to say that again.
Yeah.
For those people that are running that don't have a piece of paper and a pen,
yeah.
I want you to say that again.
Right. You cannot improve as an athlete except by altering your relationship to perceived effort. For example, if you somehow, this is impossible, but if you were able to gain fitness through training, but an 8-minute mile still felt just as hard as it did before you gained fitness, you would not be able to race any faster, because you would be, even though you had more physiological capacity, even though you were fitter, you would be psychologically incapable of accessing that increased fitness. You know, if the same pace still felt just as hard, that is your limiter. Your limiter, we always reach our tolerance for perceived effort before we reach our absolute, we never touch our absolute physiological limits. So that's sort of
the rugby players on the bicycles. Think of that.
Or for Scott, the Marines on the treadmill.
So in answer to your question, so that's the only way to improve is by increasing your tolerance for perceived effort or getting more performance out of any given level of effort. But there are actually a million ways, there's infinite ways to do those things. Any influence that alters that relationship can help you perform better. There are some common ways of getting there, ways of increasing your motivation. That's one of them. But it can be something, there's literally no limits. Like, it could be something that only you experience as an athlete that just gets you over the hump. I'll give you a personal example. So at the beginning of the book, I sort of talk about how I was a head case as a high school runner. I did not like how hard running was. I was talented, but my mental game wasn't there. And I quit the sport for a while, and then I came back to it. And when I came back to it, I wanted to get that monkey of being a mental weakling off my back. And the way I did it was actually, in a sense, by shaming myself. In my workout, I was surrounded by elite endurance athletes. And I discovered that some of them actually weren't all that much more physically talented than I was. They just got so much more out of you know, of course they were more talented, but not necessarily outrageously so. And so that sense of shame actually is what got me over the hump. I got back on the race course and I thought, you know, can you really live with yourself if you know, you finish another race and you didn't leave it all out there? And I couldn't. I got to the point where that shame was felt worse than the pain of giving my best effort. Mm-hmm. But that was very personal. You know, like you can't manufacture that you can't bottle that recipe and you know, allow anyone to gain mental toughness, you know, exactly the same way I did. So, you know, there are common ways of gaining mental fitness. And those are the ones I really focus on in the book. But they're also, it's an individual journey for each athlete as well.
You know, I've often thought of that, this mental limiter, and I've talked about it before, at least I know with you, Scott, on the trail, is if we each had a fuse that would pop at a certain threshold, I wonder what, if I could swap fuses with other people, what my performance would look like. I mean, how is my, and I caught on to what you're talking about, that the brain is kind of shut you down or hold you back. And so what if I could kind of change my hardware or my programming that I have up top?
Your relationship with
my body,
with your perceived effort.
Yeah. What if I had Scott's fuse? I might be a whole lot faster or slower.
Or slower.
I don't know.
Or slower.
It'd just be interesting.
Well, there's evidence that is true. You know, we're not at the point where we can swap brains, but for example, there was one study that was done where competitive cyclists, they were administered transcranial electromagnetic stimulation to their brains before they did a performance test, and it enhanced performance in a high intensity bout of exercise by 4%. Which is about what illegal performance enhancing drugs do. So they literally just had their brains zapped, and the zapping was focused on areas of the brain that are involved in managing perceived effort. So all this zapping did was make the familiar level of exercise feel a bit easier. Well, that's the equivalent of your swapping out one fuse with one that has a slightly higher threshold. And it absolutely works because we've all got a margin. We've all got a buffer. You know, our psychological limit is here, and our physiological limit is over here. And the idea is you want to compress that distance in any way you can. You can do that through training. You can do it through nutrition. You can do it through experience, and you can do it through overtly psychological methods as well.
How can or does a placebo effect figure into this? Where you can maybe trick your brain to having a different relationship with this perceived effort. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So
I mean, like if I bought a new pair of shoes, these new pair of shoes are going to make me faster. They're going to make me run further. They're going to, is there some validity to that?
Yes. And really the mechanism for the placebo effect in endurance sports is that it alters expectations. So you raise your bar that you're aiming for. You have higher expectations for the outcome. Now, obviously, there's limits to this. You can't step off a roof expecting to fly and fly. But like I said, all of us have a margin to work with. You know, we don't ever reach our true physiological limits. So if you go into a race with better expectations for your performance, for whatever reason, it could be new shoes, or it could be because you're now working with a coach and you really believe in that coach's methodology. Doesn't matter what it is, if you've got higher expectations, that's also why the success effect works. If you sort of just randomly knock a race out of the park and you have a breakthrough for whatever reason and you perform better than ever, well, that very experience will raise your expectations for future races, and that's what you can sort of get momentum as an athlete. So, yeah, that placebo effect really works through heightened expectations.
So let's talk about maybe having a few bad races in a row and how important it is then to find yourself a race you can perform well in, one that has everything stacked in your favor, because you can get into kind of a slump if you've had a few races that don't come out with positive outcomes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, when that happens, if it's an athlete I'm coaching, I usually, and I would do this anyway, but I try to set them up for success experiences. And that starts with training. You know, you don't want to do your toughest workouts when you're tired. You know, you'll your split times will suck, and then you'll get down on yourself, and you know, it can become a vicious cycle. So you can start the process of overcoming, you know, getting out of that kind of rut in training, where you know it's not all just X's and O's. You have to think about the psychology of training as well, and train in a way that builds confidence. And then, you know, when you get back on the race course, you can also, you know, manipulate your goals. And like you said, just in every conceivable way, set yourself up for a successful experience in that race. And then usually all it takes is one, and you've turned things around.
You know, a local runner here that I've run a lot with and is the race director at Way to Cool and AR50 that you came and spoke at, Matt, Julie Fingar, had really shared a principle with me that I've always used and carried along the way. And she says, don't sabotage yourself. Don't put yourself there out there on, say, a super hot day when you really are underhydrated and you haven't had a lot of sleep and you're going to try to stretch the miles out a little bit and there isn't a water refill somewhere along the way. Don't sabotage yourself because, one, it isn't good when you bonk like that and you end up with a great deal of catastrophic metabolic conditions. But two, you don't need to wound that mental image that you have of yourself, and you want to stay on top and always come out successful. That doesn't mean don't work hard, because there's success in working hard, but don't end up dragging yourself back to the car, back to the trailhead, and just beat yourself up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there is a tendency in some athletes, I think particularly male athletes, to think you can overcome anything with toughness. You know, if you're just tough enough, you know, you can overcome, you know, obvious barriers to, you know, things that should by rights sabotage your performance. But that's simply not true. In the book, I tell the story of Paula Newby Fraser, an 8-time winner of the Ironman World Championship, who she always trained with sort of a minimalist approach. You know, she trained hard, but she didn't train as hard as some of the other athletes did, and it worked for her. But she sort of lost confidence along the way and started to think, you know what, you know, maybe I need to train like these other athletes do. And she went overboard. She stopped listening to her body, and she became overtrained, and she had a disastrous performance at that year's Ironman World Championship. So, you know, simply, you know, just, you know, trying to do more, or you know, thinking that that it's all about toughness. It's not all about toughness. It's important, but sometimes you just need to know when to take a day off or when not to run that extra mile. So, you know, I'm emphasizing the importance of psychology, but the physiology is still there. You know, you're not, no matter how tough you are, you're not superhuman. And you need to, as an athlete, you need to pamper yourself to a certain degree.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask this question to Coach Matt Fitzgerald instead of author Matt Fitzgerald. What about how, as we look at our training logs or what we're doing, and the caution of comparing ourselves to others, where you hear a lot of long distance endurance guys and gals that are saying, yeah, the 100-mile week is just mandatory. Well, a 100-mile week for some might just tear them apart and leave them shredded and not really ready for the race at all. So how do you coach psychologically your runners when it comes to comparing themselves with others?
Yeah, there's a definite type out there, you know, the athlete who is just prone to that type of comparison. I call it the hard work security blanket, where, you know, it's really fear-based. You know, most of our barriers psychologically as athletes are, they're in fear somehow. So there's a fear of sometimes of the complexity of improvement. You know, when you get to a certain level of experience as a runner or endurance athlete, you run out of ways to improve. And sometimes it's comforting to just think, oh, if I just try harder, if I just train more, that, you know, that will solve everything. So, you know, hard work becomes this kind of security blanket for athletes. And the fact of the matter is, it's just not true. Like, it doesn't, you know, working harder is not the solution to every problem. It is not always the way to improve as an athlete. And you just need to at least at first conceptually recognize that. And I like to do it, you know, really my technique with the book is to give examples of very successful athletes who prove these points. And one that I use in this book to make that point is Bernard Lagat, the great Kenyan turned American runner who trained ridiculously lightly throughout his career compared to other elite athletes. I mean, this guy only ran once a day, which is just unheard of for, you know, someone who's winning Olympic medals and world championship titles. But he trusted himself, and he didn't look at other athletes and say, oh, goodness, you know, they're doing so much more than I am. And he always says, you know, I feel great in my training. Like, yeah, you know, I have hard days like anyone else, but I usually feel great. And that's something you can use actually to guide yourself and keep you on track as an athlete. You know, you're going to have flat days. You may even have flat weeks sometimes. But if you're training right, more often than not, you're going to feel really good in your training. And, you know, let Bernard Lagat be your role model in that regard.
You know, there's kind of a catch 22 that I'm thinking about as you're talking about that you shouldn't compare yourself. But I'm rereading the book Into Thin Air by John Krakauer because of the movie that Everest that just came out. And the one thing that interested me or that I think is just amazing is they for years and years and years, they said you couldn't climb to the top of Everest without bottled oxygen. And then somebody did it. And within a few years, all of a sudden there's like dozens of people that have done it. And so there are some external things by comparing, you know, you could take the 4-minute mile. Nobody said it could break the 4-minute mile, and then somebody did it, and all of a sudden, bam, everybody's breaking the 4-minute mile. So I think that plays into this mental psychology of what is the body's limit too, and gives you the hope or the knowledge that it can be done, so why not me?
Yeah, you have to be pragmatic as an athlete and just use common sense and don't try to look for all the answers in any one place. And often that means, you know, finding balance. You know, working as hard as you possibly can isn't the answer. And slacking off isn't the answer either. Like there's
a
place.
Wait a minute. Let me take a note about that. Hang on. Okay, go ahead.
There's a place for both, but you're absolutely right. You do to some degree. You don't want to reinvent the wheel. That's why I take a role model based approach to talking about this psychology of mind over muscle, because you can key off people to some degree, but you do that in a pragmatic way. You don't you don't lose perspective and just blindly follow what another athlete is doing. Without any regard to the feedback you're getting from your own body. You need both.
Earlier, you used the term trust in yourself. And I remember when we were speaking with Dave Mackey, and he was talking about nutrition, and he was out on a race, and he was saying, I trusted in my nutrition. I knew that it was going to be there for me to pull me through those deep miles and this extra effort. And I just like that whole trust in training, trust in the fabric of who you are. Just trust in all of those things. And I think we grow as people and as athletes and learn about ourselves a bit more when we can relax, not spend extra energy on worry, and trust that we're ready and execute. And if you're not completely ready, trust that you recognize that and trust right. Your new training program and trust your new effort level and trust your new execution plan. So you can still trust even though you haven't put in the ideal training because of whatever is happening in your life. Just trust that you can.
Yeah. You know, you remind me of the experience I had in my first and only Ironman triathlon, where I finished the bike ride and started running. And I remember, you know, as I took my first strides, my thought was, my body feels exactly like it did when I finished my last marathon.
Oh, no.
And I was in a panic. I thought, there's absolutely no way I can run 26 miles now. But then my next thought was, well, the training I did is the same training, basically the same training that thousands of people have done before on the way to finishing an Ironman triathlon successfully. So I just took a blind leap of faith and trusted in that. I thought, well, you know, I'll just take the next step and see what happens and you know, remind myself that I'm not the first person to attempt what I'm doing with the preparation I've had. I ended up negative splitting that marathon.
Wow.
It was by like a second.
Hey, it's still a negative split.
We'll edit that out, Matt.
Right.
You know, that reminds me of the exact thought process I had in my first, you know, ultra distance run, the 50-mile run, was just knowing that others use that same exact training program, that I followed the number of miles and the days per week and all of those things. So I didn't have a personal experience that I could fall back on. Yes, I've done that. The only thing that I had is I've run with people that have done it, and I kept up with them from the beginning to the end, and I followed all the directions and the step-by-step recipe process that says I should be able to do it, and I had a lot of trust in that piece because that's really all I had. So we have to trust.
Yeah, and you know that's you know a great example, but it, you know it's just one of many. It's funny what will happen. I think anyone who's done at least one race of any distance has had this experience where, you know, you get out there and you get to a new place mentally where, you know, you're suffering more than you do in any workout and your mind really gets creative. You know, when you get to that panicked place where I was at the beginning of the marathon and that Ironman triathlon, like you will find not always, but often you will find useful things to think to get you through that experience. And often, you know, you see, you know, athletes will find the same sorts of solutions. And those are the things that I talk about in the book, you know, where it's like that, you know, the same problem, you know, we're all human, we have our own personalities, but we tend to, you know, when our backs are against the wall and we need to find thoughts that will be helpful versus harmful in you know, seeing us to the finish line, certain things tend to work in that. You know, that trust thought is one of them, but you know there are a variety of others, and some of them are, as I suggested earlier, you know, highly individual.
I'll tell you, I've kind of gone. This last 2 minutes of discussion has gotten me to go back into put my business hat on. Uh-huh. In the business I'm in, we're dramatically changing the way that we're going to market.
Uh-huh.
And I have a team of people that are very skeptical about whether it's going to work. And we have some consultants that are telling us it does. We've done it a gazillion times. Uh-huh. But that's all they're doing is they're saying we've done it. Uh-huh. I think that if we had some examples of companies that have done similar strategies and have been successful, like Don was saying, he knew people that had done the training to run 50 miles, and he knew people that did it and were successful this 50 miles, and he trusted that it worked. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yep. Sorry, I'm just translating this back into my work life.
So you need to ask that consultant, who's that company?
Yeah.
Not good billions and billions of times. Let's get specifics. Yeah. Which company, doggone
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Hey, you have, back to the book, Scott.
Sorry.
Chapter one.
It is during work hours.
A race is like a firewalk. Let's talk about that. How is a race like a firewalk?
Yeah, so that's the recurring metaphor in the book. So here's how I tell you to envision it. So imagine you're standing before a bed of hot coals. Your feet are bare. At the end of that bed of hot coals is a wall. That wall represents your ultimate physical limit as an athlete. So a race is, you know, like beginning that walk towards the wall, and every step you take hurts more than the one before. Now, to be clear, perceived effort is not pain. They're just distinct perceptions. This is a metaphor, but the pain of the heat on your bare feet represents perception of effort. So the further you go into a race, the harder it feels, the harder it feels, the harder it feels. No one is psychologically capable of handling enough pain to reach that wall. It's just a human impossibility. You know, we would be able to literally exercise ourselves to death if that weren't the case. So you'll never get to the wall. You will decide, I can't stand anymore, and leap off that bed of hot coals at some point, even if you're the toughest athlete who's ever lived. Now, that point where you leap off the bed of hot coals represents your current psychological limit. So there's going to be a certain amount of distance between where you leap off and where the wall of your ultimate physical limit at the end of the bed of hot coals is. And one of the things you want to do as an athlete is compress that distance. So the next time you do that firewalk, you're closer to the wall that you'll never reach when you finally leap off. And again, it's a metaphor. It's not about quitting shy of the finish line, but it's about like, you know, just how close to your absolute limit can you get through, you know, psychological means and whatever means are at your disposal, except performance-enhancing drugs.
Thank you for that. Because at TRN, we do not endorse performance-enhancing drugs.
Just performance-enhancing Cocopellis.
Well done.
So that brings up a question. You said that no one has ever reached that wall of where their body just gives up.
Yeah.
Is that true? Has there ever been anybody, doggone it, just mentally tough enough that they have completely exhausted their body?
Yeah, so this could quickly become semantic, but okay. with respect to perception of effort, if there are various limiters, like you could suffer heat stroke during a race, right? And that'll take you out. That is a purely physiological limit, but that's not fatigue. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about the limiters of garden variety fatigue, like acidosis in the muscles or glycogen depletion in the muscles, you know, those things that we think of as, you know, the physiological performance limiters, those things, there's always a buffer at the point where an athlete gives up. So the best way to test this is to, you can't do it so much in a regular race, but if you put an athlete on a treadmill or a stationary bike at a certain intensity and you just say, go forever, never stop. Well, guess what? Everyone stops at some point, right? Well, they stop when they can't take the suffering anymore. When these experiments are done and the scientists take measurements to see, okay, how acidic have the muscles become? Have they reached the critical point where we know muscles are not able to function anymore? How glycogen depleted have the muscles become? Are they absolutely glycogen depleted, or is there some still available? Every time these studies are done, there is always a reserve mm-hmm. in those capacities. Always, always, always. It's just that, you know, I know, you know, a lot of athletes just don't like to believe it, and some just won't believe it, but we all have, you know, you can be taken out of a race by a tiny little pebble in your shoe, right?
Right.
Well, that pebble is not actually hurting you. You know, it's causing it's not killing you. It's not causing irreparable damage, but everyone can only take so much pain from, you know, that little pebble over and over and over. And there's also other experiments where there are ways of experimentally inducing pain that cause no harm to the body. So there's a sensation of pain, but you're not actually being damaged. And again, in all of those experiments, every single subject has a limit to their pain tolerance, you know, which is purely psychological, purely. They're not, you know, again, their body's not being affected whatsoever.
So what you're saying is the brain has a governor, and as a safety device will shut you down from running, that no one continues to run into the grave, but they will stop running. They may be so fatigued that eventually they fall into the grave, but no one's going to just run directly into it.
Right, but it's not, you know, it's not like an automated subconscious governor. Well, there's some debate over this. There's the Tim Noakes school that does make that argument. There's just like a you know, a fuse is tripped, and you slow down involuntarily. The guy who wrote the foreword to my book, Samuel Amarcord, he's from a newer school who says, no, it's voluntary, it's conscious, and it is purely psychological. So, because that idea of an unconscious governor, it's really just moving your physiological limits up into your brain. It's not, that doesn't really change anything. But, I mean, there's a reason we have a conscious experience, that we're not just robots that move around without perceiving anything. Causal things happen on the conscious level. So, you know, if you did not feel the misery that you feel during a race, you would pace yourself very, very, very differently. So that's really the school of thought that I believe in, that it's not this this preconscious homunculus calling the shots in our brains, but we actually voluntarily give up.
I think that's the first time we've ever had the phrase preconscious, subconscious homunculus.
Is that yes.
I think that's the first time we've ever had that phrase on the.
I used it in what's that game you play when you put letters together? What is that?
Scrabble.
Yeah, Scrabble. I used it in Scrabble. That's a big point. Hey, now Matt, I know that you're an author and a coach, and I know that you're not a veterinarian, so I don't expect you to answer this. All right. But Will a horse run himself or herself till they drop?
No, they have perceived effort as well. I mean, the psychology, it is very different in important ways. A horse can't have a concept of a finish line. So, you know, a horse couldn't distribute their effort as intelligently as a human can in a race, because they're not capable of that type of foresight and planning. A horse also is not able to derive motivation in the same way that people do. Like, you know, people will push their limits just for ideas. You know, in the last chapter of the book, I talk about Steve Prefontaine, and for him, exercising mental toughness on the racetrack was a high principle for him. I mean, it was sort of the meaning of his life. Well, a horse can't motivate itself in a race that same way. For them, they love to run. I don't know what horses motivate themselves with. they get a bunch of hay after, but
I'm gonna get some grain.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap. You know, like a horse. The psychology is simple enough. I mean, it's similar enough that that it can't exercise itself to death any more than we can. But there are also important differences.
So let's talk a little bit about the horse and the person too, and how competition and being competitive can move some of these thresholds. Because I've got to think the horse must be competitive. I think there must be something that's why their eyes are on the side of their head, so they can see where that other horse is. It's racing.
I think the motivation comes from some spurs
and a whip. So let's talk about competition and being competitive and how that can move our thresholds.
Yeah. So again, like I said earlier, there's a long list of factors that influence our relationship to perception of effort, and competition is one of them. There's some complexity to it, though. Part of it is something that's called co-activation. So if you do any sort of exertion in a group, so you're co-acting with others, because we're social beings, doing that actually lowers perception of effort, probably through endorphin release. So there was an interesting study I mentioned in the book involving rowers, where they were asked to row by themselves, and then they were asked to row like with a team of eight. And then they were subjected to a test of pain tolerance. Their pain tolerance was higher after the workout was the same. It was just a matter of whether they were around other people or not. Mm. So that's one aspect of it. But that's not really competition. It's cooperation. But competition actually is cooperative. But there is another element where it's just part of the, you know, the dark side of you that just wants to be the best and, make other athletes cry because of their failure. So that, you know, that works by increasing motivation. That's why, you know, you are generally more motivated in a race and you can dig deeper in a race than in any workout, in part because, you know, we're all a bit competitive. So you will be willing to tolerate a higher level of perceived effort because of competition. And then there's a third element, at least one other element of how competition elevates performance, which is that it externalizes your focus of attention. So there's good research showing that if you are working hard in a race and you're focused on your body, or if you're focused internally, you actually cannot tolerate as much pain or suffering, and you experience a higher level of suffering at any given level of performance. But if your attention is more externalized, you can go to the wall in a way that you can't when you're focused more internally. So competition turns your attentional focus sort of away from your body. It's almost like just you're paying attention to your suffering less because you're paying attention to your competitors more.
I like distractions.
And I think you spoke about that up here when you were at American River 50, about how you personally have set some of those milestones or triggers out in front of you intentionally on a race to be held accountable or to run towards them. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So, yeah, in my personal experience as an athlete, I will one example, I think the one you're referring to that I spoke about was about getting older as an athlete. And, I'm 44 now, so I'm slower at pretty much every distance than I used to be, but I'm still competitive. And when I race now, I will key off younger athletes who are about in my vicinity, you know, say if I'm 6 miles into a half marathon or whatever, and there's some younger guy next to me, I will allow him to make me angry. And like, I'm going to show up that younger guy who isn't past his physical peak, you know, the way I am. And it's, you know, I suppose it's childish psychologically, but it's useful and it works. And, you know, that's all that matters. You know, I'm not going to haul off and hit the guy. I'm just using him to sort of motivate myself. So that's,
you're not going to trip him.
That's one example.
You're not going to run in front of him and take all of the filled bottles of fluid and tip the table over so he can't have any.
So, I have done that.
You got to do what you got to do.
So we've talked about trying to get us closer to that metaphorical limit or that wall, walking on the fire coals. And you said there's literally thousands of ways you could do that. Has the research shown, or are there coaches that have proven that there's, you know, give us two or three good techniques that we can do to improve our mental toughness?
I'd say first buy the book because it's in there. Okay, just a plug. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what, you know, the book has 12 chapters, and each one of those chapters focuses on a different coping skill. And each one tells the story of some great athlete who used that skill to overcome some major setback or failure. And so one example is what I call bracing. So this is one you would use before competition. Bracing yourself really consists of expecting each race to be your hardest one yet, that you want to go into a race. Expect it's sort of the attitude you need to have when you go for a root canal. If you tell yourself, you know what, this is really going to hurt, you know, like you're what that sounds like it's pessimism, but you're actually just getting yourself ready. Because there's good research showing that if you're not the more suffering you're prepared for in a race, the more you'll actually be able to tolerate. So you don't want to go into a race saying, oh, I hope this is one of those magical days when I just float along and it doesn't even feel, because you're setting yourself up to not be able to tolerate, as much perceived effort. So you want to go into a race expecting it to be one of those grinding affairs and therefore ready, to slog through that kind of race. So that's one.
Hey, can I kind of piggyback on that comment?
Yes.
About that when you do that bracing and you really anticipate being challenged with the most difficult experience of your life, when it's not that, because not all of it's going to be that, when it's not that, you're so happy and grateful and positive and optimistic, and you feel like you're cheating the system because it's supposed to be the worst thing that ever happened. And that really reinforces a very positive experience when you're running and you're not doing that. So even when it feels like just the mediocre stuff, when you're not feeling like you're on the cloud, you're still happy and positive because you're not going through that braced moment. So that's what I've experienced.
So what about if it's not something that you've braced yourself for? You know, you're going into this race and you're thinking, okay, I'm going to prepare myself. I know that this is going to happen. And that doesn't happen, but something unexpected does. What kind of tools can we use other than just, you know, looking at our the palm of our hand where we wrote, how bad do I want it?
that should do it right there. That's all.
I mean,
need.
What kind of strategy can we use to buck out of something that was not expected?
Yeah, good question. To be clear, this gets us away from perceived effort or perception of effort. So you're no longer, you know, you brace yourself for a high level of effort, but yes, other things can go wrong. A shoelace can come untied. You drop the nutrition you were carrying and, you know, decide and think, do I go back for it or not? Those types of things, you know, just little mishaps that befall you, you know, flat tire, if it's a bike race or a triathlon. In those, you know, the athletes who seem to survive those kinds of contretemps the best are the ones who remain calm. So it's just, it's nice to have specific strategies in place, like contingency plans, you know, if X happens, I will do Y. Cause that can not only, you know, it can not only be the right thing to do, but having that plan in place, you know, can have the desirable calming effect, but, you know, still truly unexpected things can happen. You know, you could be directed the wrong way in a race. And, you know, how frustrating is that? You know, you were prepared for, you know, 10K and, you know, you don't have it to run 6.5 miles. So, yeah. You know, in those cases, just having a calm response is the way to go. Just even if you're like naturally sort of a more anxious person, and those people exist, just simply knowing that you need to remain calm and that is the best way to handle the situation. So there should just be a trigger. When one of those unexpected things happens, you think, oh, crap. And then your next thought is, I need to stay calm.
Absolutely. There's all kinds of things. Part of the bracing is, and anything else that might come up.
Right. I think one of the things that I love about trail running and ultra distance endurance running is getting to know people on the trail and hearing their stories. And I think for me, that's where I drive some strength and some mental toughness to hear the stories. Like you said in the book, I mean, there's 12 stories in here of different 12 chapters in here of different stories of people that have reached a limit or a perceived limit and overcome that. And that's where I get excited.
Mm. Yeah. You know, it's what's cool about those stories is that they're some of the best athletes who've ever lived. and yet, you know, they're just like us. And that's actually one of the higher missions I had with this book and that I have as an author, is that I don't like it when people assume that the greatest athletes have it easy, you know, because they won the genetic lottery at birth and, like, you know, hard work just comes easily to them. You know, it's like one of the cool things about the work I do is that I interact with a lot of these athletes. And, you know, the way I sometimes put it is, imagine yourself on the start line of the Boston Marathon and you're the guy or gal who is expected to win it. They're talking about you on television. They were talking about you on the internet pre-race coverage. You are expected to win. Imagine that pressure that you would feel out of those 30,000 people. Like, if you don't win, it will be a surprise and disappointment. Well, that's exactly how the person who is expected to win feels. You know, just how you would. You know, and so when you see that, you know, these really fundamentally normal people who, yes, are gifted. When you see that, you know, they go through the same things we do and, you know, they achieve things that seem miraculous to us. I find that really empowering. Like I do get a lot from the stories of everyday athletes as well, but, I have a particular fondness for seeing, you know, athletes with unparalleled talent also fail and, you know, have to, you know, kind of reach deep inside themselves into their soul or self for something special, you know, to bounce back.
You know, and to your point of the book, it really is that there's an additional variable besides physiological abilities that are out there. Otherwise, we could just, you know, test VO2 max or heart rate or lactic acid threshold and say, well, here's your winner, and
don't even have to run it.
And we don't have to run. We just go down the line because this person is best suited for endurance activity. But there's something completely different in there. And that would be interesting. And have they done it? Because you're well read. Are there studies that say, okay, let's take these parameters and let's look at them, make predictions, and now let's run the race and see what happens?
Are you talking about on the psychological side?
No, well, I'm really talking about a physiological assessment and then run the race. You know, do predictions based on the physiology, things we can measure, and then let them run.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's been done. They've sliced it up pretty much any way you can imagine. When I'm giving my sort of racing weight type of spiel, one of the studies I cite, it involved 21 elite level Ethiopian runners, and what they did is they statistically lined them up in order of their body fat percentage. Now they're all lean, but there were small differences. And then they kind of shuffled the deck and statistically lined them up in order of their best race times. Mm-hmm. And of these 21 athletes, it was almost exactly the same order. So they could just take body fat measurements and know who would win the race and who would finish last. So it's a, you know, sort of endurance performance physiologically is it's somewhat overdetermined. So, you know, you might hear that study and think, okay, so it's all about body fat percentage. No, because you could find a non-runner who's extremely lean who would spoil those results. You know, so you can do the same thing with VO2 max or certain other physiological variables. It's not a huge list, but there are a lot of physiological variables that are highly predictive of success in endurance racing. What I find most intriguing is the psychological studies that do the same thing, and that's, you know, some of the newer research coming along. One of those types of studies that I refer to in the book is a test of pain tolerance. The way I sometimes describe it is this: imagine you've got a room with a radiator, one of those old style radiators that's next to the window you can actually sit on, and everyone has to sit on the radiator, and then it's turned on, and then the heat. No, it's all athletes in some sport, and the heat is gradually turned up. And then, you know, it's like one by one, people, you know, say, okay, I'm hopping off. So you record the order in which people hopped off the radiator, and then you have them race. And again, the results of that test of pain tolerance would be highly predictive of their performance in a race. And there are other types of psychological predictors that are even more interesting.
That's very, very interesting. I think that's fascinating. You know, Western states they've done a lot of studies. You know, we're the 380 to 400 runners that run from Squaw each year to Auburn are also a big laboratory experiment for some of the medical staff that are out there.
Yep.
And I remember reading, and they're great for that. And there's a lot of published literature out there on that, and it's available. And if you're interested, that's a good place to go. And one of the studies I remember reading was about exactly that pain tolerance. At the beginning of the race, they would do like a pinch test and see where you tapped out, and you say that's enough.
Right.
And they do it at the end, and they found out that your tolerance increases as you go through that race.
Yep.
That's an interesting.
That was just done last year or 2 years ago.
I think it was. I don't know. My internal calendar is off. I don't know. So I have a question for you. So you have athletes, because you're a coach. Now put your coach hat on and not your veterinarian, because you proved to know something more about horses than I thought. Pretty impressed with that. So now we have...
We've never been able to stump Matt, have we?
Not yet.
Either that, he's really good at making things up.
It could be that. I'm a little worried you're going to hear from a veterinarian after this show.
It's the cowboy hat you're wearing right now that really gave me confidence in you. So...
Yeah!
And that. So let's talk about now, coach, your athletes are coming. What do you coming to you? What do you find that needs most coaching, the psychological side or the physiological side?
Okay. So I don't want to weasel out of this, but they are, it's almost impossible to separate them. But just in the spirit of your question,
I will say
psychological. I mean, this is why elite athletes have coaches. You know, in terms of X's and O's, these athletes can coach themselves, but they don't. I mean, very few choose to do so, and that's because you never outgrow, your need for some psychological help.
Yeah.
As an athlete, so it is both. I'll give you an example. The single most common mistake that people make in their training is going too hard on easy days, you know, just getting stuck in that moderate intensity rut, trying to make every single run count a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, never really going to the wall in workouts because you're going halfway to the wall every day. So that's the biggest mistake, but it's really a psychological mistake. You know, it's because people believe that they need to make every run count because they're skeptical of the idea that a workout that feels good could actually do them any good.
No pain, no gain.
Yeah. So, you know, I would consider that, they're physiologically holding themselves back by training wrong, but the process of overcoming that is just all psychology.
Well, I don't think you weaseled out of that at all. I think it was just a poor question or a question that had, a multiple number of answers. So without scheduling the next podcast, it'd be hard to really dive into that one. With your amateur versus elite athletes, more recreational, but serious. I mean, we take our sport serious, and anybody that gets out there and pins a bib on is serious about what they're doing, or they couldn't or wouldn't go out there. Do you find that the elites, you said, do not need so much X's and O's on how to train, but really need maybe a bit of a reassurance or some coaching or some directing to keep their head straight? Do you think maybe there is a delineation where your elites need a little more brain tweaking and your not elites need a little more physiological tweaking?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, because the elites don't train wrong.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be elite.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They just don't. So yeah. And the elites will use coaches in somewhat different ways than recreational athletes would. You know, I mean, the kind of pressure you experience when your livelihood depends on your performance that's unique to the elites. You know, like, you know, I can have a bad race and I don't lose my job. So it's different. But, you know, there's some overlap. You know, racing is hard no matter how good you are. So, you know, to that extent, and that's really the focus of the book, the psychology is the same. And, you know, coach could help you in the same ways, whether you're elite or recreational.
So I'm going to ask a question then. For us amateurs, how important would it be to have a coach that could help us work through some of those psychological things?
But, you know, you don't necessarily need a coach. I mean, here's what you do need. You know, if you are serious about your sport and you're not just one of those people who's just psychologically, you know, perfect, which is, I mean, who's that? What you need is someone to save you from yourself.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, because you get, you know, it's just, you know, none of us sees ourselves the way other people do. We get trapped in our own perspective and we think, you know, it's a good idea to sneak out for a run at midnight during taper week just to test if you're really fit. You know, that suddenly seems like a good, like you would think anyone else who suggested that is an idiot. But when you're tempted to do it, you know, you just don't see that you're an idiot.
Take your own advice.
Yeah.
Right. So that kind of thing, just having a sounding board, you know, it could be a training partner, you know, mm-hmm. just someone who's not even necessarily more experienced than you are, but they're just not you. And they can, you know, they can hold a mirror to you in a way that's hard to do for yourself.
Well, I hold in my hands the book, How Bad Do You Want It? Mastering the Psychology of Mind Over Muscle by Matt Fitzgerald, author, coach, cowboy, veterinarian. It depends what question you're asking him. On the back it reads...
Athlete,
thank you. It reads on the back, the greatest athletic performances take place in the mind, not the body. And that raises some chills
in my arm.
If
that doesn't pull out your wallet, I don't know what will.
A lot of good chapters in here. One thing I like to do when I open up a new book is look at the contents, and it makes you just want to read each one of these chapters. You know, the group effect, what do you expect, the gift of failure, you know, time is on your side, brace yourself, just all good topics, mm-hmm. and makes the book well worth it. And we've had Matt on before. He's got a list of books.
He has 22 books, including, you know, Racing Weight, the Racing Weight Cookbook, Quick Start Racing Weight Guide.
80-20 Running.
Yep, that's his last.
Run Stronger and Race Faster. We have Run on here. We've talked about that. Brain Training for Runners, a revolutionary new training. So all kinds of stuff. All you have to do is Google in Matt Fitzgerald books, and you'll find a library, and guaranteed you'll enjoy each one of them and become a better runner for it. So, Matt, you're awesome.
Thank you. You are awesome as well.
You know what? That's my new ringtone.
I need to get that.
I'll send it to you. I'm not going to charge you for it, pal. You can have that ringtone. Matt Fitzgerald, always contributing and making running better, more fun, and it helps us understand what we're doing out there. Because running is just a fascinating way to improve who we are.
One of the things I first heard when I started doing this was... and you'll probably correct me because I obviously get things wrong.
does it start with the Marine?
It's 90% mental and 10% in the brain, or
in your head,
something like that.
Yeah, that's about the Marine on the tightrope.
On the treadmill. treadmill. Yeah.
Thanks, Matt. We appreciate it.
Always great to talk to you guys.
Now go out and run.
Mas. So
remembers bridges, burns them to the grill. I have become cumbersome to this world. I have become cumbersome to my girl. Too heavy, too light, too black or too white, too wrong or too right, today or tonight. Too rich or too poor, she's wanting me less and I'm wanting her more.